CBS News, Philadelphia, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Representative Thomas P. O'Neill, Jr. of Massachusetts, Speaker of the House of Representatives. Speaker O'Neill will be questioned by CBS News national political correspondent, Bruce Morton, by CBS News congressional correspondent, Susan Spencer, and by CBS News correspondent Fred Graham, who is substituting for the moderator, George Herman. We shall resume the interview in a moment, but first, here is Fred Graham.
Thomas P. O'Neill, Jr., who has been known as Tip O'Neill for as long as anyone can remember, is a politician who has become a living symbol of something that he has probably never been in fact. O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives, has been made famous by his Republican opponents as the living exponent of the free-spending people politics of the Democratic Party. In a series of recent television ads, the Republicans used an actor who strongly resembled O'Neill's white-maned, red-faced Irish visage to portray a politician bent on irresponsibly pumping money into domestic social programs. O'Neill has been willing to accept the characterization, flailing back at the Republicans for their cutbacks in domestic spending. But in fact, his long record in Congress has been far less ideological than that. He has concerned himself mostly with the politics of the House and of his Boston congressional district, and until recently had not been identified as a strong proponent of domestic social programs. Tip O'Neill was born 69 years ago and has been active in Democratic politics in Massachusetts and Washington most of his life. He came to Congress in 1953, filling the seat vacated by John F. Kennedy when he moved over to the Senate. O'Neill became a behind-the-scenes power on the Rules Committee, but was little known nationally until he broke with President Lyndon Johnson in 1967 and came out in opposition to the Vietnam War. He became House Majority Leader in 1972, and when Speaker Carl Albert retired in 1976, O'Neill won the job by acclamation. His lot has not been a rosy one under President Ronald Reagan. Democrats in the House have consistently broken away to support Reagan budget-cutting proposals, and O'Neill has suffered a series of defeats despite a 53-seat Democratic advantage in the House. O'Neill has stubbornly refused to change his policies, insisting that the pendulum will swing back toward the Democratic platform. But he has seemed discouraged at times, and rumors persist that he might soon retire.
And now we continue with Face the Nation.
Speaker O'Neill, in response to my first question, you characterized the new Secretary of State, designate George Shultz, as a team player. But you seem to say that not in admiration, but with some sort of reservation or concern. Why?
Well, the reason I say that is that I think that there should be a tremendous distinction between the Secretary of State, who is the ranking cabinet member, and the Secretary of Defense, who's further down the line. I think that there was a policy dispute between Haig and Cap Weinberger, and I think that ultimately it's apparent to me that Cap Weinberger won out on the difference, I believe, of Israel, on the way we were to handle it, and on the Russian pipeline. I think that they should be free and distinct. I believe now that you won't have the voice in the president's cabinet of a difference. Cap Weinberger and the new Secretary of State, Bechtel, operate us together. They're very friendly. They're very strong. It looks to me as though Cap Weinberger is the strong man. So, the strong man on the president's cabinet should be the Secretary of State.
Are you saying, Mr. Speaker, that you're afraid that our Middle East policy is going to be tilting now too much toward the Arabs?
Well, I don't want to make a flat statement of that type, but there's no question in my mind that Haig was for our ally, the Israelis, in this situation, and I think Cap is going to take a harder and a tougher route.
Is this, in general, do you think, Mr. Speaker, a win for the hardliners? Or are we going to be tougher
very definitely
with the Russians?
I would say that this is a win for the hardliners that have been supporting Reagan since probably 67 when he first ran for office. I think very, very definitely. I think they were opposed to Haig from the beginning, and we know that there had been opposition out there, particularly from the hardliners, who were the instrument of Reagan being elected as President of the United States.
Well, does that mean a more confrontational policy towards the Soviets?
Well, we get down to the pipeline, and as I understand it, Haig thought that the Americans ought to participate. It's going to be built anyway. There's no question about that. I think that Haig's viewpoint on it, that we were going to have trouble with France and some of our NATO countries over there who wanted that pipeline. I think that the administration believes that Russia is vulnerable at the present time and that we shouldn't be in there. It was a question of whether we'd act severe with Russia, which Cab Weinberg wanted us to do, or we would go along with our friendly allies. I think that's what the difference was about.
Mr. Speaker, you mentioned the Bechtel Corporation a minute ago.
Yes.
And the fact that there will now be two members of the cabinet from that corporation.
And there are others, I understand, in the lower echelon of the Reagan administration.
Now, the Bechtel Corporation does represent Saudi Arabia and their close ties there. Do you think that this should be looked into in the confirmation process of George?
Oh, I think it'll be looked into closely. I would hope that wouldn't be a cause of action for determining our foreign policy, but I think that'll be one of the things that'll definitely be brought up in the confirmation in the Senate.
Now,
but I don't want to talk for the Senate.
Now, in that connection, we're talking about the Middle East. There's been some talk about the need, perhaps, of an investigation now of the Israelis to see if they have violated their agreements with us by using American-made weapons aggressively. Do you think that should be done?
Well, that's very interesting. That's under the Arms Act. The President of the United States, when we sell military equipment to any country, it's only for defensive purposes. The Congress of the United States doesn't make the judgment as to whether or not that was used. The Defense Department and the President of the United States make that finding and report, or should report, to the Congress of the United States.
Would it be
your
recommendation?
It's not for me to say that that they haven't been used, because I haven't been briefed that much. Ultimately, the President should inform the Congress as to what his opinions on it.
So you think
that's
where
the law specifies.
And you think there should be an investigation of this?
I don't think there's any question that there will be. That's an obligation of the President's.
I see.
The Democratic Mini Convention here in Philadelphia is winding up today, and one of the things that they did was discuss a policy position which is very supportive of Israel's action into Lebanon. Are you generally of the opinion that Israel acted in as Israel claims, purely self-defense?
Well, again, that's a judgment that the President is going to have to report. Very interesting. I agree with the policy as passed by the Democratic Committee. First of all, the best thing that could happen to Lebanon would be for everybody to clear out. The Israelis, the Syrians, and the PLO. I can understand the position of the Israelis when they get into there. There have been so many bombs tossed at the Israelis by the PLO and by the terrorists, and they found tons and tons and tons of ammunition. Now, it's my understanding the United Nations passed a resolution that everybody pull out, but they didn't mention anything about the terrorists, and they didn't mention anything about the equipment and the ammunition. I don't blame the Israelis for wanting to capture all the ammunition and get rid of it.
You know, in speaking about the mini convention, there's been a lot of comment about the unity here and the lack of dissension. Do you think that, can you say that there was anything really accomplished, though, as a result of all of this unity?
Oh, very definitely. This is one of the finest conventions I've ever seen. It's brought together the Democratic Party from all the phases of our philosophy, from conservative, ultra-conservative, moderate, progressives, liberals, ultra-liberals. It's brought us all together, as it did in the 30s. And the reason it brought us together in the 30s is the same reason that it's bringing together now, the unfairness of the Reagan program. When I say the unfairness of the Reagan program, he promised 13 million new jobs, 12.5 million people are unemployed. The next generation will be the first generation in America less educated than the generation before. The senior citizen, the anxiety that they're going through on Social Security, on Medicare. These are the problems that are bringing us together. The unfairness of the Reagan economics and the Reagan program is bringing the Democratic Party together.
Well, would you say that you're just going to walk away with the elections then?
I can't say that. I've been reading the polls, as we all in public life do. Some of the pollsters say we're going to win by 50 new votes out there. Well, history shows that in the off-election of the first-term president, the party not in power, and the Democrats are not in power, normally win 15 seats. On the second term of a president, the party not in power usually wins an average of 28 seats. I would say that we're going to win somewhere between 10 and 20 seats. That's my feeling, yes.
Do you have any concern about being just outspent by the Republicans?
Oh, there's no question. That's the biggest problem that we face out there. They'll be outspending us on a ratio of 15 to 20 to 1. But we hope to be able to raise about $16 million. I understand that they have in their coffers over $100 million. It's my understanding in the last 30 days that they intend to spend on the media $50 million. They're going to try to buy the election. There's no question. It's going to be propaganda. It's going to be the criticism of the Democrats through the years.
It's going to be the criticism
of the Carter administration. They're going to try to run on the past instead of that record.
Isn't there and a point to be made that
it's
if the
propaganda
Democrats,
all the way? They're going to try to buy the election.
If the Democrats had better candidates, they wouldn't have all this trouble raising money, and they too would have.
No, basically, we've never been able to raise too much money through
the
years.
Why is that?
It's very interesting. Well, you know, they like to say that they have more small givers. Any given letter, I understand, out there, there's a response from the conservative element of America, those who are satisfied and those who have done well under the Reagan program, those of the wealthy people of America, to be perfectly truthful, they're going to fight for the gains that are theirs. You know, they've made tremendous gains in the taxes. What are we doing? We're sacrificing middle America and the poor to the wealth of America, and the wealth doesn't want to lose the gains that they've made.
Mr. Speaker, one of the things that came up here at the conference wasn't resolved. What was talked about is the issue of party accountability. Usually, the case of the boll weevil, somebody who consistently voted for the Reagan budget, for Reagan policies. Are you sympathetic to the idea that somebody who most of the time votes against the mainstream of his party ought to be disciplined somehow?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because we've had better discipline on the Democratic Party than we've ever had in any time in the last 30 years, and it goes back to the golden days of Sam Rabin. Now, why do I say that? Well, approximately 90% of the Democratic Party has always stayed with us. Through the years, we never needed the boll weevils. We always had 25 or 30 Republicans, moderate and liberals, particularly from the northeast of the country, who always voted with the Democrats. We lost 43 Democratic seats last year. And so the discipline in our party has been good. Now that the boll weevils haven't been voting with us, but for 30 years they haven't been voting with us. The Republicans, interestingly, have voted in robot step. All of those northeastern and city Republicans, they have voted. The Republicans also have better discipline than they ever had before. Now, there are those who want to criticize the boll weevils and say we should punish them, that the Speaker should remove them from the committee. Our day of reckoning is the week of the first week in December of every other year, when we meet to formulate the rules. That is the particular time when we elect the members to the committee. That is the time for the people to stand up. If they want to write into our rules of our caucus that you must go along with the rules as offered by the leadership, the previous question and things like that, and punish somebody for that reason, it's not in our rules at the present time. Secondly, I've seen punishment along the line. I saw a man leave our party and go to the Republican Party and get elected and take a Democratic district, one of the first. I saw a man removed from the second spot in the committee to the last spot in the committee, go home and become the governor of his state. Punishment hasn't worked out there, to be perfectly truthful. But the interesting factor, it's in the caucus where these things should be done. There is no way in which we can remove a man from a committee, because it goes from the policy committee to the caucus. And after the caucus elects him, it then goes to the floor. It's a perfunctory matter when it goes to the floor. But in order to remove a man, you've got to start where you finished. You've got to start and remove him from the committee by a vote of the Congress. And that's an impossible thing to do. I think we're going to have an extremely interesting caucus this year. I think you're going to try to see some moves to put into the rules specific things in which, if a man doesn't vote with the will on the orders, I don't mean the legislation itself, But I mean on the technical questions of supporting the Rules Committee or supporting a point of the previous question, I think that's going to be one of the real basic discussions that we're going to have in our caucus.
You say it's better discipline than ever, but the point is that now is the time that you need them. Now is the time when it really counts. Why have you not been able to more effectively lead the party this year? Why once again were you trounced on the whole budget? What happened?
Well,
you said in May
thing.
That this
you know,
was going to change.
Let's talk about last year.
Let's talk about this year.
Well, let's talk about this year. We lost our vote this year by a vote of 220 to 203, our alternative program, which would have been a protection for a middle-class America, in which we would have created a housing program, in which we would have created some jobs for the people. We lost to Boll Weevils. I truly thought we were going to win. We did a tremendous amount of work. We had every faction out there that's interested in legislation working behind the scenes for us. But what happened to Boll Weevils? From the discipline of the White House has no Democratic bill under any concern. So they voted against the Democratic bill, and most of them voted against the Reagan bill. So we do have discipline out there. So what is it all about? We want more Democrats. Why do I think the tide is turning out there? Because the unfairness of the Reagan program. Why do I think that we're going to win about 15 seats? I think we're going to win about 15 seats because of the unemployment, because of the AIDS, because of the housing programs, because of the interest rates, because of the bankruptcies out there, the entire unfair program. And as we look at the records, Democrats are more bound together than they have ever been. On the last vote, by the way, we gained about 20 of the 43 Boll Weevils.
And yet you couldn't override the president on the housing subsidy.
No,
you can't pass a farm crisis bill. You're talking about a jobs bill, and there's certainly no guarantee that that's going to pass.
No, there's no guarantee, but what are we doing? We're bringing the issues to the president of the United States, who apparently is oblivious to what is happening in America. We're bringing the issues, and we brought the housing issue to him. He vetoed it. I truly don't understand the man. We're less than 600,000 homes going to be built in this country this year. About 20% of the trade industry of housing is unemployed. And here we were with a bill that would lower interest rates and stimulate the economy, that we'd have 300,000 to 500,000 new homes in there, and we'd help turn the country around. And he vetoed it. Now we're going to send to him an unemployment bill. I presume he'll probably veto it. But in doing this, we're calling for a midterm change. We're saying, Mr. President, your policy isn't working. Your policy is unfair. Will you stop being oblivious to what is happening in America and get down to the basics that we should stimulate the economy out there? And we're not going the old line of how we used to do it. We wanted to get into high technology and train people. We want jobs for summer youth. We want to not just work jobs for the sake of putting people to work. We want jobs for the infrastructure of America.
One thing you're not talking about here, Mr. Speaker,
yes?
Is where the money is going to come from. You've spoken about a $5 billion housing construction program. We're going to have a $104 billion deficit if we're lucky.
At least.
Right. Where are you going to get the $20 billion in new taxes?
That's the obligation of the Republicans. It's their bill that passed. As a matter of fact, the bill that we offered was about $30 billion in taxes. The president himself, in his original bill, he asked for $12 billion. Most of them may use the tax fees. Now it's we're waiting for Dole and the Finance Committee to see what kind of a program we got. We're the opposition. We're the opposition. You know, the first time we brought the budget bill up this year, we should have passed it. As a matter of fact, I think I had an implied agreement with the leadership that the final bill would pass. And what happened out there? President of the United States, I believe I don't recall whether he was out of the country or not. Yes, he was out of the country. He said, Democratic bill should not pass under any circumstances. And at that particular time, I thought we were going to pass the committee bill. But don't pass the Democratic bill if you pass it. Don't pass anything if you have to vote the Democratic bill. Every bill had been defeated, and it was our bill that was lying there.
Do you think the public is going to think that that's a responsible course for the Democratic Party and specifically the Speaker of the House to take to say, we've got a huge deficit, we know it's driving interest rates up, but we're not going to help you find a solution?
Well, ultimately, it's their obligation. We are the opposition. What is the attitude of the president? The attitude of the president is accept nothing that the Democrats have offered. I don't know what kind of a program Dole is going to come out with. Certainly we're going to come out with a tax bill if they failed. Under reconciliation, we have to do that. Our convention is a very interesting convention. As a matter of fact, we've got new programs in there, new programs and taxes. One of them was the Miller bill for a balanced budget and new programs to vote new taxes. Others is the Gephardt-Bradley bill, a progressive flat tax bill.
What do you feel about that, Mr. Speaker? There's been a lot of talk about going to a flat tax without so many deductions.
Well, there's no question that there's some merit to it.
You think it has a chance?
I don't think it has a chance this year because I don't think the Republicans would buy it. The Republicans are not buying anything. You say to me, why don't I come out with a program? Any type of a program that I come out with, I know that the president is going to veto. He's wedded in glue to his program of 5-10-10 and 10-5-3 and the kickoffs afterwards. He is just wedded in glue. He truly believes that it's going to work. Every time I see him, he said to me, my program is working. I'm not hurting people out there. Well, number one, his program isn't working, and he is hurting people out there. There's no answer to him when I say, well, you cut $41 billion last year out of the budget. How do you say that your program isn't working?
Let me ask you, you said once that he didn't know anything about the budget. Do you think the president really understands this process?
Well, after a year and a half, he surely should. But a year ago, you know, when we passed in the closing days when we get all tied up, I said to the president, you know, it was implied last night by Baker at 2 o'clock in the morning that you would sign this this continuing resolution. He said, well, I can't sign the continuing resolution. I said, well, we have what they call an impoundment law. You have rescission and you have referrals. There had already been billions of dollars in rescissions and referrals, and I must say, on the conversation, the president had no knowledge of what I was talking about. I think from then, he probably now, even in the budget that we sent him the other day, which was $1.3 billion, over what he had asked for. He had the right of rescission and deferrals, but I don't think he knows sufficient about it. I don't think he knows, to be perfectly truthful, the rescissions and deferrals that Dave Stockman has sent over there.
Do you think there are those who criticize the whole budget process, saying it's basically a meaningless exercise, these are just targets, and this year the committees are not going to do what the budget tells them they have to do? Do you really expect the House now to be able to, A, enact a tax bill, and B, go ahead with the kind of cuts that are mandated in that budget?
Ultimately, yes. Will there be squabbles about them when the reconciliation comes along? The answer, again, is yes. And the interesting factor is, I'm for the budget system. You know, the American people know very little about the budget system. We didn't have a budget system in being until about 5 years ago. We have 13 appropriations committee. We authorize, and these bills go. And the budget committee today is a target. There's an agreement between the House and the Senate as to how much the deficit would be. And when I sat down with the president, two things we agreed upon. We agreed that if nothing was done, the deficit would be $184 billion, and we agreed that the deficit would be between $100 and $105 billion. It was where the cuts and where the spendings were going to be that we had the differences over, but the financial market knew that the ultimate budget was going to be between $100 and $105 billion.
Sir, we just have a couple of seconds and a couple of quickies. In the wake of the Hinckley verdict, do you think that the insanity law should be changed?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I was as shocked as anybody in America was. As I understand, there's no written law on that. That comes down from decisions of the court. I think the Congress, the Judiciary Committee, will be looking into that, and I think the Senate will also be looking into it.
I'm sorry, but our time is up. Thank you, Speaker O'Neill, for being here with us on Face the Nation.